Assalamu alaikum students. On behalf of the Ministry of Science and Technology, Virtual University and Mubashir Humayun, I welcome you to another lecture in financial management. We are continuing the concepts that have been covered in chapter 13 of Brigham and Kubinsky, 8th edition, and we are going to talk today about the capital structure theory. We will talk about the Miller-Modigliani propositions in theory and also changes, adaptations, and modifications of this theory so that it is applicable to the real world and practical problems. But before I move on with the new content, let me recap some of the important concepts that we have been speaking about for the last couple of lectures. We began in capital structure talking about the weighted average cost of capital, which we said is a very important figure to calculate because it tells a firm what the minimum required rate of return it should expect from new investments that it makes in projects and securities. We mentioned that we can calculate the weighted average cost of capital, or WACC, as a percentage. It is equal to RDXD plus REXE plus RPXP. It covers three different types of capital, D for debt, E for common equity, and P for preferred stock. The R terms in the WACC formula refer to the required rate of return adjusted by the impact of taxes and transaction costs. Transaction costs, remember, are those costs that are associated with issuing a particular stock or bond. There are costs that have to be paid to the printer, to the accountants, to the investment bankers, and to the brokers whenever you are issuing or selling a security like a stock or a bond. And these are known as transaction or flotation costs. We mentioned that we need to calculate the cost of these different types of capitals by adjusting the market price by the transaction cost. So we talked about net proceeds, or NP. And you can replace the price term in the formulas for Gordon, which allow you to calculate the required rate of return of a stock. Replace the P naught, or market price, by NP, or the net proceeds, which is equal to the market price minus the transaction cost. We also mentioned that when we talk about the cost of equity capital, that we need to keep in mind that we can calculate the required return of equity based on the Gordon's formula for stock pricing, or based on the capital asset pricing model, in which we calculated the required rate of return based on the beta, or the market risk, and the risk premium. Practically speaking, a firm has two general ways of raising equity. It can either convert its retained earnings, which are basically savings of income that it has collected over the years, and convert that into common equity and issue common shares against it. Or the company can issue fresh equity and sell common stock in the open market. Now, depending on which approach you use, the cost of equity capital will be different. We then spoke about the total standalone risk for a firm. Before we moved into the capital structure portion of this course, we were studying risk and return theory, and in that we were looking and focusing our attention on a single stock. For a stock, the total standalone risk was equal to the company-specific or diversifiable risk plus the market risk. Now we are focusing our attention on the firm, on the entire company. And the total standalone risk for the firm is equal to the business risk plus the financial risk. Now, we make this distinction because our perspective is to focus on capital structure, and we want to separate the impact of debt. The total standalone risk for a firm that has both debt and equity can be measured in terms of the standard deviation of the ROE, or return on equity, for the levered firm. And the business risk, which is the risk associated with the operations and assets of a business, and does not include any debt is basically measured by the standard deviation of the ROE for the unlevered company or the company in the case of 100% equity. The business risk is associated with fluctuations and changes in the prices and the costs associated with the operations of a business, and business risk increases with operating leverage. Leverage is that phenomena that magnifies or enlarges effects. Operating leverage enlarges the effect of changes in sales. So a small change in the sales can lead to a large change in the earnings of a company or in the ROE, return on equity for the shareholders. The operating leverage is equal to the fixed costs divided by the total costs. And operating leverage can be good or bad. It's like a knife. You can use the knife in a good way, or you can use the knife in a negative way to hurt people. Similarly, operating leverage is good provided that the firm has a healthy amount of sales. If the sales of a firm are higher than the break-even point, then operating leverage can be beneficial because small increases in the sales can lead to large increases in the return on equity for the shareholders. But by the same token, when operating leverage increases the average amount of return on equity, it also increases the overall amount of risk because it enlarges the effect of sales on return on equity. And whenever there is an enlargement of the effect and a larger spread or variation, then risk increases. We then spoke about financial risk, and we mentioned that financial risk is created by debt. When a company takes on loans or when it borrows money, it takes on financial risk. We also mentioned that the financial risk is proportional to the financial leverage. And financial leverage is defined as the ratio of the debt to the total assets in a company. In other words, it's equal to debt divided by debt plus equity. The financial leverage also has a magnifying effect. And in this case, small changes in the earnings or EBIT of a company can lead to large changes in the ROE for the shareholders. So again, financial leverage can be either good or bad depending on the health of the company. If the company is healthy and if its overall return as measured by EBIT divided by the total assets is higher than the cost of debt or interest, then financial leverage can be positive or can be helpful. And in this case, a small increase in the EBIT can lead to a large increase in the ROE. However, increase in financial leverage not only increases the average ROE, it also increases the risk or the uncertainty in the ROE. It increases the standard deviation of the ROE as well. We then spoke about the capital structure theory. And we spoke about the capital structure theory because there was a question that we raised, which was that financial leverage goes to increase the average return on equity for the shareholders, but it also increases the risk. So the question is leverage or is debt good or bad? And how much of it is good? And to answer this question, we started talking about the capital structure theory. And I introduced to you the founders of the capital structure theory, which are Professors Modigliani and Miller, also known as MM for short. In 1958, they came up with a revolutionary article in which they introduced the concept of capital structure and explained its impact on the value of a firm and on capital budgeting. This paper was entitled The Cost of Capital, corporate finance, and investment decisions. And the professors won the Nobel Prize for their work. Now, Miller and Modigliani assumed an ideal situation. They assumed a world in which there are no taxes, no bankruptcy costs, and where all of the investors and shareholders and managers in the market have the same amount of information. These are major assumptions which they made, and therefore their results are not exactly accurate. They were aware of this fact, but they have important consequences in our understanding of the impact of capital structure and debt on investment decisions and on the value of a firm. Now, the major conclusion that Miller and Modigliani came up with was that capital structure, or the amount of debt or borrowing that a firm takes, has absolutely no impact on the value of that firm. In other words, whether a firm has 10% debt or 90% debt in its capital structure, according to the MM theory, based on ideal conditions, this has no bearing on the value of the firm. And this result is surprising to us because we just said that increasing debt increases the level of risk of a firm, so that it should have an impact on the required rate of return, which is used to calculate the NPV. But there is no such link when you assume that there are no taxes, no bankruptcy costs, and where all of the investors have the same amount of knowledge. This is also an important conclusion because it says that the area of capital budgeting and investments can be entirely separated from the area of corporate finance. In other words, we can study investment decisions and calculate NPV without knowing anything about the capital structure of a firm. And that is exactly what we did in this course. We studied capital budgeting first. We studied investment decisions for a firm without going into any details about whether this firm is 100% equity or 50% equity or what its capital structure is. Keep in mind that what MM's theory says is that the amount of debt that a firm has no bearing on the valuation of that firm based on the NPV formula. How can this be? Well, according to this theory, the value of a firm is derived from what? Something that we have been speaking about right from the beginning of this course. We mentioned that the value of a firm, or the value of real assets, working assets that are in operation and in business, that value, that fair value or intrinsic value, is based on the future cash flows that are generated by the assets. Future cash flows from the operations and the business. So what Miller and Modigliani said was, basically, whether the capital of a firm is 100% equity or 50% equity or 100% debt, this has no bearing on their ability to do business and to make sales and to cut costs and to increase revenues. They have a certain cash flow pattern, and that pattern will continue whether they have 50% debt or 100% equity or whatever. They said that the value of the firm is, as we have been mentioning all along, determined by the cash flows, not by the capital structure. In the real world, however, the situation is different. In the real world, we have taxes. In the real world, businesses go bankrupt and they close down. And that closing down of a business has costs. Real money has to be paid. And in the real world, not all of the investors in a market are rational. Not all of the markets are efficient. And not all of the investors have the same amount of knowledge or information. You, after having taken this course, inshallah, will have better knowledge than most of the other investors in our markets. So not every investor is at the same level. And because these assumptions of the Miller-Modigliani theory don't exist in the real world, we have to make changes in the model so that we can make it practical and apply it to daily real-world problems. So the first change or modification in the pure Miller-Modigliani or MM theory was made by Miller and Modigliani themselves. And the first change that they incorporated into the theory was the introduction of taxes, or the impact of taxes on the best capital structure that a firm should have. Miller and Modigliani studied the taxes in various countries, and they came to the conclusion that in most countries around the world, the corporate tax that firms and companies pay to the government favors debt rather than equity. Why is that? The answer is something we've talked about already. We mentioned that when a firm takes on debt, the interest that it pays is tax deductible. Firms do not pay tax on the interest that they pay to the bondholders or to the lenders. This is a tax saving. If a company raises capital through debt, then it saves tax because of the interest payments that it makes. This is known as a tax shield or a tax shelter. However, if the company issues equity and it pays dividends, then those dividends are not tax deductible. So there is no tax advantage associated with the dividends that a company pays to its shareholders. Therefore, according to the corporate tax laws around the world, companies would prefer to raise money through debt rather than equity. However, the story does not end here. We have just talked about companies or firms and their perspective. However, Miller and Modigliani also pointed out that you have to look at the investor, the person who is giving the money to the firm. In this case, the individual investors have to pay personal income tax. Individuals pay personal taxes. So in the case of personal taxes, the situation is reversed. In this case, if the individual investor or firm receives income in the form of interest from investment in debt, then it pays a higher personal income tax than on the income that it receives in the form of dividend from equity. In other words, what we're saying is that the personal taxes in most countries around the world for interest income is higher than the personal tax on dividend income from equity or from capital gains, which are the increases in the price of a share. So, according to the personal tax laws, most individual investors would prefer to invest their money in equity. Now, the effects of corporate tax and personal tax are contradictory to each other. The net effect, basically, and generally speaking, is that the corporate taxes are more important, and generally, taking both corporate and personal taxes into consideration, companies would, by and large, prefer to raise money in the form of debt. Now, let us talk about the next major change that was made in the MM theory. That was to incorporate the effect of bankruptcy costs. In the real world, companies face problems in cash flows. Their sales might drop. They face more competition. The interest rates might go up. Their debt servicing charges might go up. They start incurring losses, making operational cash outflows. And this can lead to a company having to close down or go bankrupt. When companies close down or they go bankrupt, there is a real cost. They have to pay real money. Companies cannot die in peace. Very recently, I also heard that in some countries, individual people cannot die in peace either, because when they die, their family has to pay a death tax. And they have to pay all types of taxes for the grave and so on. Same way with companies. Companies don't die easily. And there are costs associated with bankruptcy or the death of a company. The company has to pay costs to the lawyers who are structuring the close down of the company. They have to pay costs and fees to accountants. Companies have to pay their dues to trade creditors to whom they owe money. And companies are oftentimes forced to sell their assets at prices that are well below their fair value because they have to sell the assets quickly and repay the debt holders who have the first claim on the assets. So these are all costs, real costs of bankruptcy. In fact, even before a company goes bankrupt, even the threat of bankruptcy or a rumor of bankruptcy is enough to create problems for a company. When the market spreads a rumor that such and such company is unhealthy and about to go bankrupt, then this company has to face real problems. For example, the suppliers of raw material to this company might refuse to supply raw material, thinking that the company will not be able to pay them back. The suppliers of raw materials to the company might not extend credit facility. The buyers or the customers might cancel their purchase orders, thinking that the company will not be able to supply on time because they're going bankrupt. And worst of all, the banks and their lenders would increase the interest rate that they're charging because they think that the company is more risky now. And these are costs, real costs, that take place even though the company has not gone bankrupt yet. There's just a threat or a rumor of bankruptcy, and it leads to real costs for the company. Therefore, as good citizens, I would not advise you to spread any bad rumors about any company going bankrupt, because it will start to, the news will spread, and it will start to affect the company in the form of real costs. So, practically speaking, in the real world, firms that are excessively leveraged or that have too much borrowing or debt are more likely to go bankrupt. Not just that, there are certain types of firm where a large amount of debt is more likely to make them go bankrupt. And those are firms that have high operating leverage. We've spoken about that already. High operating leverage increases the business risk and hence the likelihood of bankruptcy. Another type of firm where high amount of debt can be dangerous are those firms which have illiquid assets, assets that cannot be easily converted into cash. These firms are illiquid and they might have short-term cash flow problems associated with their ability to pay regular interest monthly or quarterly, so there is a greater chance of bankruptcy. And finally, those firms where the earnings are not stable and where they fluctuate a lot, these firms can have difficulty because they don't have steady short-term cash flows and they may not be able to service their debt. And again, it's likely that they might go bankrupt. Now let's take a look at the trade-off theory. The trade-off theory makes a couple of changes in the pure MM theory by taking into consideration both taxes and bankruptcy costs. And in the trade-off theory, we start by looking at a firm which has 100% equity capital, and then we see what happens as the firm gradually increases the percent of debt in its capital structure. So as the firm becomes more and more leveraged, we are interested in seeing what the effect of debt or increasing leverage will be on the value of the firm as measured by the value of the stock. Remember that the value of the firm is simply equal to the value of the stock multiplied by the number of stocks or shares. That is a rough calculation for the value of a firm. So let us take a look at the graph which shows to us the concepts that the trade-off theory is trying to weigh. If you take a look at the trade-off theory graph, then you will see that we have the value or price of a stock on the y-axis and the financial leverage, which is equal to debt divided by assets, on the x-axis. The financial leverage can be seen as a percentage or as a fraction. And on the graph, you will see that I have shown 1.0, which means that at that point, 100% of the capital is debt. Now, let's take a look at the lines on this graph. First of all, the horizontal line represents the case of the firm when it is 100% equity. This is the unlevered firm. And let us assume that because this firm has no debt, therefore, the value or the price of the stock is not sensitive to the financial leverage ratio. However, now let us take the case of the same firm if it gradually adds more and more debt to its capital structure. And now let us trace our path from the left-hand side of the upside-down parabola or the curved line. Let us move from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. So if you start at the left-hand side on the y-axis, at that point, the firm has no debt, therefore it has the same value of the price as the unlevered firm. And initially, when the firm takes on a small amount of debt, then it is slightly leveraged, and it receives an interest tax shield benefit. There is a tax saving associated with the interest payments that it makes on the debt. And therefore, the total return to the investors, which includes the net income paid to the shareholders plus the interest paid to the debt holders, that total return to the investors increases. Therefore, the stock value of the firm will also increase. And that is why you see that the line initially rises. However, it will reach a maximum point, and that maximum point is the point at which the value of the or the price of the stock will be maximized. That maximum point is the optimal capital structure. This is the best capital structure, the best ratio of debt to equity, the best financial leverage for this firm. And this is also the point at which it will minimize the weighted average cost of capital, or WACC. After this point, the firm has taken on too much debt, and this excessively leveraged firm now faces higher interest costs, the possibility of a loss of suppliers and buyers, and the threat of bankruptcy, which has real costs, and therefore the investors will lose confidence in this firm, and its share price will drop, and it will continue to fall. And it will continue to fall and perhaps even fall below what the value of this share would have been if it took no debt at all. So what the trade-off theory tells us is that there is some optimal or best capital structure. There is some value or percentage of debt that is ideal for a particular firm at a particular time. Do we know what that value is based on trade-off theory? No. We don't know whether 30% debt is best, or whether 50% debt is best, or whether 100% debt in the capital structure is best for a particular firm. This is just a subjective analysis, qualitative analysis. In order to compute numerically what the best ratio of debt to the total capital should be, we will talk much later on, perhaps in the next lecture, about the combined effect of weighted average cost of capital and the capital structure theory, and we will then be able to estimate a numerical value for what the best capital structure or the best mix of debt and equity should be. For now, let's move on to the next modification to the Miller-Modigliani theory, which is the signaling theory. The signaling theory is basically a modification or a change in the Miller-Modigliani theory that takes into account a practical fact in the real world. And that fact is that not all of the investors in the market are rational, and not all of them have access to the same amount of information. Obviously, the managers in a particular company and the owners of that company have a lot more information about that company and its financials than any outside investor might have. Insiders is what we call the managers and the owners and the workers of a particular company. They have more information about that company. They have more knowledge about its profitability, its actual cash flows, its future plans of expansion. And therefore, they are in a privileged position. In fact, in most countries around the world, there are laws against insider trading. Insiders, owners and managers, and staff of a particular company cannot use their knowledge about information which is private to a particular company by buying and selling the shares of their own company. And many very famous people, including Mr. Ivan Bosky in the United States, have gone into jail for insider trading. Now, what the signaling theory says is that there is a difference between what the managers of a company know and what the rest of the outside investors in a market know about that company. The managers know more. And because they know more, they use this fact to their advantage. How do managers use this fact to their advantage? Quite simply, the managers know the real picture. The managers know when the future outlook for a company looks good or bright. They know if they expect, realistically speaking, the sales of a company to improve in the next year. They also know if they realistically expect the sales to go down because of competition or some other market forces. Now, depending on whether they think that or they know that the health of a company is going to go up or down, they will make a different choice regarding what type of capital to add in the form of either debt or equity. Let me explain. What I'm saying here is that according to the signaling theory, managers have more knowledge about their own company. They know if this company will be making more money in the near future after a year, if the sales of this company are going to go up or down. And according to the signaling theory, if the managers know that the future outlook of this company looks good, in other words, if they think it's going to make more money in the next year or two, then these managers are smart people. They're rational people. If they have to make an investment knowing, or rather, if these managers need to raise capital from the open market, knowing that their future looks good, then they would rather raise the capital in the form of debt rather than in the form of equity. If they know that the future of their company looks good, they would rather raise the capital in the form of debt. Why? Quite simply, because if they raise the capital through equity, they would have to share the profits of the company, which look quite good, with a lot more shareholders. And they don't want to do that. Smart managers do not want to issue more equity when they really think that the company's future looks good. Why? Because they would have to share the profits with more and more shareholders. And they won't get as much profit on a per share basis. Similarly, if the managers know that the future of their firm looks bad, in other words, if in the next year or two they expect their cash flows to fall, their sales to fall, because competition has increased or certain other market forces, then they would prefer to raise capital for the company in the form of equity. Why? Because they know that they might be making a loss, or there are more chances that they will make a loss, and they want other shareholders to share the loss with them. They can't take debt if they think that the future looks bad. Why? Because if they think that the future looks bad and that they might have operational losses, then they know that they will not be able to service their debt. And that they cannot afford, because if they don't repay their debt, then they might legally be forced to close down and declare bankruptcy. So this is the logic of the signaling theory. The smart managers who think that the company is going to do well will prefer to issue equity, and the smart managers who think that their company is not going to do well in the near future will prefer to raise capital in the form of equity. So then, what are the important conclusions from the signaling theory? The first important result is that, according to the signaling theory, firms should maintain slightly less leverage than indicated by the trade-off theory. In other words, they should keep a percentage of debt to the total assets which is slightly lower than the optimal point indicated on the trade-off graph. Why? Because firms should save some reserved debt capacity for the future. Firms should save some reserved debt capacity for the time that they find an attractive project or investment which will provide them a rate of return which is higher than their cost of debt, number one. Number two, they should maintain a reserve debt capacity, because at that time, when they think that they have found an attractive project, then it is better for them to raise money in the form of debt, because they won't have to share the profits from this attractive project with other shareholders. So they need to save a little bit of debt capacity so that when they find a new project and they want to raise debt in order to invest in that project, that they give the right signal to the market. If they raise equity instead, they will be giving the wrong signal that they expect their future cash flows to be weak. Finally, one of the reasons why firms should save a small amount of debt capacity is that it helps for a firm to maintain a limited amount of debt, because it enforces a certain amount of discipline in the management. Managers know that they have to service the loan every month or every quarter, every 3 months, and therefore they are not as wasteful in their expenditures as they might be otherwise. Now, let's talk about the situation where the firm has to raise money in the form of equity. When they try to do this, they are giving a negative signal to the market. The signal that rational investors in the market get if a firm decides to issue new shares, especially healthy large firms, when they issue new shares, the market investors get a different signal. It's a negative one. They think that the future cash flows and profits of this firm will drop. Therefore, these investors start selling the shares of this particular firm, and the share price in the market drops. When the share price in the market drops, then the required rate of return for the investor increases. And when the required rate of return for the equity investor increases, then the weighted average cost of capital for this firm increases. And the discount rate at which it calculates the net present value of its investment opportunities also increases. In other words, when a firm that is healthy decides to issue new equity, then it can force a situation whereby it increases its weighted average cost of capital, and it is forced to reject projects that are good but that do not meet its minimum required rate of return criteria based on the weighted average cost of capital. Let me stop the new contents for this lecture right here, and let us go over some of the concepts and formulas that we have spoken about so far. We began in this lecture recapping the formulas and concept of weighted average cost of capital. We spoke briefly about the standalone risk of a firm, which is equal to the business risk plus the financial risk. We mentioned that operating leverage increases the business risk and financial leverage increases the financial risk of a firm. We mentioned that we can measure the risk of a firm in terms of the standard deviation or the variation in the return on equity. We then moved into the capital structure theory, which attempts to answer the question, what is the ideal amount of debt that a company should have? What is the optimal capital structure for a company? And the linchpin and the starting point for all of these theories is the MM, or Miller-Modigliani theory, proposed by Professors Modigliani and Miller in 1958, for which they won the Nobel Prize. According to their theory in its purest form, with many, many assumptions, the corporate structure, or the amount of debt that a firm has absolutely no bearing on the value of the firm as measured by the net present value. And this is an important conclusion because it tells us that we can entirely separate our capital budgeting decisions from our corporate financing and capital structuring decisions. This is why we could study capital budgeting in this course very early on without worrying about debt and capital structure. The reason for this is quite simply that the value of a firm, as we have been mentioning all along in this course, the fair value or intrinsic value of assets and of firms is based on the future cash flows generated by these assets. And Miller and Modigliani simply said that by shifting the capital structure or by increasing the percentage or lowering the percentage of debt, if you are not changing the forecasted cash flows of a firm, then you're not changing the value of the firm. That was their logic. However, Miller and Modigliani made many, many assumptions in coming up with this conclusion, and we don't find these assumptions to be true in the real world. These assumptions included no taxes, no bankruptcy costs, and equal amount of knowledge and information for all investors in the market. We then spoke about changes or modifications in the Miller and Modigliani theory, which help us to apply the theory to the real world. The first modification that we talked about was made by Miller and Modigliani themselves when they included the effect of taxes. Basically, corporate taxes favor debt and personal taxes favor equity. Corporate taxes take the point of view of the firm, and it has tax advantages associated with raising capital in the form of debt, and personal taxes take the point of view of the individual investors who have to pay a lower personal tax on the dividends that they get from investment in equity. But the net effect generally is that the corporate taxes are more important, and therefore the firm is generally better off based on taxes alone to raise money in the form of debt. We then spoke about the trade-off theory, which takes into account both the taxes as well as the bankruptcy costs. In the trade-off theory, we looked at the graph, which demonstrated that when a 100% equity company takes on a small amount of debt, then the value of the company and the value of the stock goes up because there is a net tax saving associated with the interest payments. But this value of the stock or the company reaches a maximum point, which is the optimal capital structure and the point at which the weighted average cost of capital is minimized. And after that, when they take on too much debt, the bankruptcy costs outweigh the benefits of the interest tax shield, and the value of the stock and the value of the company will start to come back down or decline. We finally spoke about the signaling theory, and the signaling theory says that not all of the investors in the market have same amount of information, and we have to remember that managers, when they think that the outlook and the future of their company looks good, would prefer to raise capital in the form of debt, and when they think that the outlook for their firm looks bad, they would prefer to raise money in the form of equity. And therefore, the investors in the market are always getting signals based on whether a firm is raising capital in the form of debt or equity. And the important conclusion here can be summarized as follows. The important conclusion from the signaling theory is that firms should save a small amount of debt capacity, called the reserve debt capacity, for the time when they find an attractive project and they need to raise debt. They will prefer to raise debt so that they don't have to share the profits from this project with other shareholders and partners. And in addition to this, firms should save a debt capacity because when they need to take debt to invest in this attractive project, they're giving the right signal to the market. They're giving the signal that they expect their cash flows to look good in the future. With this, I close the modifications to the Miller-Modigliani theory, and we will continue in the next lecture talking about the weighted average cost of capital as well as capital structure in order to calculate the optimal capital structure for a company. In the following lecture, we will continue our discussion of capital structure, and we will combine it with our knowledge of the weighted average cost of capital in order to practically calculate and compute the optimal or best capital structure. I would like to close this lecture here. Thank you for your kind attention and patience. On behalf of the Ministry of Science and Technology, Virtual University of Pakistan, and Mubashir Humayun, Khuda Hafiz and Assalamu Alaikum.